It is time for the single coolest sports show in the country, The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics.
You've got Matt Bonner, who my notes tell me is a sandwich blogger named Red Mamba. I mean, how can you not like a guy like that?
And the Red Rocket knocks down the triple.
Red Rocket, I'm telling you, Red Mamba might not miss a shot.
Just like in politics, in the instructional video business, you need credibility.
You want credibility? I'll give you credibility. Hey, Tim, what's my nickname?
The Red Rocket.
No.
The Sandwich Hunter.
No. Fry Gun.
The Medium Fundamental.
Welcome to The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. I am Chris Ryan here in the great state of New Hampshire. Matt Bonner in San Antonio, Texas. Spurs dealt the Celtics one of the only heartbreaking losses of the year, and it was a phenomenal basketball game and a season of phenomenal basketball games for the Boston Celtics. We'll touch upon that with Matt here in the opening segment, talk some hoops. Also coming up on the program, Jason Tatum and Marcus Morris from the Seas, Philip Dorsett, Patriots wide receiver. And we started a conversation on the program a number of weeks ago in which Matt questioned what Bob Cousy would be able to do in today's game. And so I decided to take this to some of the old school guys that come into the Garden, like real old school, like Satch Sanders. And also Derek Harper came in. He does TV for the Mavericks. I also talked to Giannis and Dirk on the program. We'll hear from them as well. Matt, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Great. Appreciate you joining us for the program. Now, I did not mention you by name in talking to Satch and to Derek Harper in the conversation that we had. I left you out of it, but they pushed back. They pushed back a little bit about whether or not, you know, the old school guys could play in today's game. And Satch Sanders, as you know, is one of the more articulate and amazing figures in basketball history. So that conversation is well worth the listen coming up in the final segment of the show. And Derek Harper got rather agitated because he is upset with the fact that people are saying that, you know, the game today is better than it was back in the 90s. And his argument is that the 90s game was the best game, and there is no other argument. He likes the game today, but there. So we'll talk about that in the final segment of the program with those guys. We'll start, though, with the Celtics and the Spurs. And, you know, what a basketball game that was. And, you know, for me, obviously, it's always awesome to see Manu Ginobili being Manu Ginobili, and it's even more remarkable to see him doing it at the age of 40.
I agree. You know, that entire ball game was pretty incredible. The let me think back here, because it was a few days ago. I remember at one point I was watching the game, and I'm looking on the court, and I'm thinking to myself, all right, Spurs are playing the team with the best record in the NBA, and on the court is Davis Bertans, Bryn Forbes, Brandon Paul, and nothing against players like that. You know, they're NBA players, but I'm thinking, you know, this is who we have on the floor, and we're winning this game, and then we went on to win the game. I think there's, with the Spurs, once there's still so much room for improvement once Kawhi comes back, which I think should happen any day now.
Yep.
It'll be interesting to see what type of run, given health and given continuing to get better and improve and embracing the process, that the Spurs can get to. I'm excited for it. And you know, the Celtics, same thing. You know, they lost Gordon Hayward first game of the season, and you look at their success and the way they've played together, and how guys who we talked about needed to make that next step development wise, I think have exceeded all expectations to give them that depth and a number of guys who can be that X factor on any given night. It was pretty cool to watch. You know, it's just two teams. You look at their roster and you kind of, on any random night or any random point on any random night, look at the guys on the floor, and you got to kind of scratch your head as to how they're some of the top teams in the NBA.
We all remember the the great movie White Men Can't Jump. Actually, I don't know if it was that great, but it was a movie called White Men Can't Jump. And, you know, the Spurs are Woody Harrelson or like any old school hustler. Like, you, they come out on the court and you're like, how did these guys beat us? How are they at 19-8 on the season? And you consider, you know, the skill and the talent levels of the teams that they beat. And you're so right about, you know, the Celtics are to some extent that team too, because the Celtics play and mirror a lot of what the Spurs, you know, do. But they do have, you know, Kyrie Irving and, you know, Al Horford, and Jason Tatum is going to be a huge star in the league. And the Celtics do have, you know, a lot of high quality talent. The Spurs do too, but, you know, Marcus Aldridge is there, and he's one of the best bigs in the NBA. Pau Gasol's an old cagey veteran, borderline Hall of Fame guy. So the Spurs do have talent, but it's kind of teams play them, and it's like, how did this happen? It's been happening for years. And even more so this year than in previous years, where you look at them and you're like, How did we lose this game? And you could see that when Kyrie missed the shot. Like, that was really the look on his face, was, you know, there is no way we should have lost this game to the Spurs, but somehow we did.
You're right, and I think the answer to that is the character of the players that are on the team. Yeah, because at the end of the day, you can have all the individual talent you want, but it's a team sport. So you get guys that really buy into that team concept and play together, create that synergy. And then how and why do they do that? Because of the coaching. You know, each team has a great coach who's, you know, X's and O's aside, really gets everybody to play together. And that can overcome, you know, on a individual one-on-one basis, talent gap with other teams. And that's what we're seeing.
The thing, too, is the Spurs and, you know, the Celtics now, too, they stick to what they're good at, and there is a base from which that they work. There's not a lot of freelancing that occurs. Guys, and this is true for a lot of NBA teams, but, you know, more so than others, the discipline that is put into play, where guys shoot their shots from their spots, the guys that slash, the guys that are the great defenders, they defend. And they repeat that over and over and over again. And, you know, that's the thing that's always stood out about the Spurs, is that, you know, Manu Ginobili is not going to beat anybody one-on-one anymore. But when LaMarcus Aldridge comes over and sets a screen for him, he's going to stick a shot from the spots that he's going to stick them from. And he still has, you know, the ability to you know, shake and bake and move and put the ball into good places. But he's still, you know, despite the fact that there is this, you look at Manu and you see like this creativity that's occurring, you know, particularly at this age, it's very condensed to the point of which where he does the same things kind of continuously, but it is it still kind of looks the same, so to speak.
Yeah, you're right. And Tony Parker, I was throwing him in there.
Tony's
too.
The same way, yes.
I mean, he's been injured for almost 8 months and beat his timeline to return by 6 weeks. They were saying after New Year's for him, and he comes back about, you know, almost 6 weeks before that, and literally looks like he hasn't lost a step out there, because it's like a muscle memory, basketball IQ, know what you do, and then everybody... You and everybody around you knows how to execute. And you talk about LaMarcus coming to set a screen for Manu. It doesn't work if LaMarcus doesn't set his man up, sprint into the screen, so maybe his defender's a little late on the
switch,
the push, or the hedge, or however he's guarding it. And Manu knows what angle to take to set up his spots to get his shot. Everybody around him is in proper spacing to open up the lanes or create a help situation where you have an advantage, so that when Monty passes it, that guy can drive a closeout or take an open shot or reverse it quickly, so then that guy can do the same. And just everything works in unison to create an efficient offensive possession. And that's how you win a basketball game, by being disciplined and executing for more minutes than your opponent, regardless of how much talent you have. Yeah, you know, after that, you got to make shots and all that kind of stuff. But if you have a good team playing together, you can create more advantages and over the course of a 48-minute game, that'll help you win a game.
One of my favorite parts of Coach Pop's shtick, if you will, with the media, is it happens every single pregame press conference he has. A reporter from the opposing city, or Boston or New York, or wherever, will ask him, you know, what do you see from Kyrie Irving? What's he doing to play better? And Pop will say, I don't know. I haven't watched the tape. And then they'll be like, they'll stare at him, and they'll be like, and then they'll ask the question again. He's like, no, I don't watch the opposing team. I get enough to worry about with my own team. And you know, to me, I don't know how true that is. And of course, Pop may not watch it, but he has, you know, as we've talked about, a dozen assistant coaches basically who can watch the film for him and video guys and so forth, and can give him information about how they're going to adapt and match up. But I think that a part of it too is that there's a lot of times in coaching or in playing, you know, there's this adaptation and focus on what the opposing team is going to do. They have this guy, and therefore we have to, you know, do this. Or they put in this play, and therefore we have to react to that play. Where you know, the Spurs and the Celtics both feel that, and if I guess this is kind of the case, I guess, with any superior team, is that we need to worry about what we're going to do. And if we execute our defensive sets and we execute our offensive sets, the other stuff doesn't really matter. And if you start to play into whether your opponent is beneath you or above you, or start to focus too heavily on that, I think that kind of dilutes the process. And it's not true for all sports. Obviously, in the NFL is geared towards matchup schemes and is extremely intricate in that area. The NBA, it's different. It's a matchups of feel, execution, and preparation, and those things I think get diluted at times if you focus just specifically on and overly on the opponent.
You're right to a certain extent. You have as a team, you have a defensive system that should be able to take care of 99% of situations that arise defensively during a game, provided you play hard, you got to bring the effort, and right, provided you communicate. Communication is probably the most important thing. Everybody's always talking on the same page. A lot of fires can be put out by switching, especially late in the shot clock, if you have to. If a guy gets cracked or someone loses their man, and you have to switch, you can do that, and it can buy you time, buy you success. Like I said, especially late in the shot clock.
And that's one of the reasons.
Yeah, I mean, and then the other 1% is just making a play. You just got to read a situation and make a play. Now, within the system, there's certain tweaks you can do based on personnel that you're playing. You know, if you're Ray Allen, you're going to chase him over the top of every single screen. You're never going to go under because he's going to step back and shoot the long-range shot. If you're guarding, I'm not going to throw anyone under the bus, but if you're guarding someone who can't really shoot, you're not going to close out hard on him or chase him over the top of every screen so he can curl into the lane.
I am not going to mention the first guy that came into my mind.
But you gotta make guys beat you with their weaknesses. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you know, if you apply the personnel report to your defensive system and communicate and bring the effort, you don't really have to specifically, address or tweak too much stuff on your game plan.
It's The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. We're gonna get to the middle segment here of the program in just a little bit. Jason Tatum. Hear from him. Also, Marcus Morris, Dirk Nowitzki, and Giannis Antetokounmpo coming up as well. And the last segment, is the game today, the NBA, better than it has been in years past? We'll have that great debate in the final segment of the program. This is The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. Final thing here is, You know, we've talked in a lot about how the NBA has become a league where you have, you know, interchangeable guys, guys who are like 6'7", 6'8", really skilled, you know, athletic, big, long, and how they can handle the ball. And there's been a lot of focus on the offensive side of the ball, but I think you brought up a good point here indirectly about the defensive side of the ball, where if you're, you know, switching and you're switching on D, it's good to be able to have that same matchup that you want and kind of have interchangeable guys, so that if you're, you know, your point guard is, say, Isaiah Thomas and is 5'6", and Isaiah Thomas on a switch ends up covering Giannis, that's a big problem. But if your point guard is, you know, Ben Simmons, then that's not as big of a problem as it was before.
Yeah, you're right, and that's a huge difference between where the game was and where it is now. Even when I came into the league, I mean, when I came in, it was more like the 90s.
Yes.
It was a lot of really big guys on the front line, traditional bigs, not a lot of stretch fours, never mind 3-4s who kind of did both. The game has evolved in that regard. And, I mean, in my personal opinion, it's made it a lot harder to score. Like, that was a great point on the defensive end when, you know, a huge way in the game of basketball to gain an advantage is to, you know, set a pick and roll and force a big man to have to hedge or help out on the pick and roll on the guard. And then the guard can either penetrate the big and score or kick it and cause a closeout or throw it back to the big or hit the big rolling. Or the weak side has to pick up the roll and then you whip it behind your head. If you're switching that stuff, all that disappears. And you got a guy like Draymond Green and Kevin Durant on the Warriors switching onto those guards, there's not much of an advantage. And it really just stops an offense and makes it tough to score off those pick and roll situations. You got to find other ways to do it. You know, you could argue back then, well, those big guys will just go down and post up and go to work on the block and either score or force a double team and gain the advantage that way. But it's a lot slower and harder to initiate an offense with a post up in that traditional sense. And just coming down in transition, getting a pick and going. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, maybe I tend to think the way the game's evolved now is, I mean, you put a team like Golden State in the 90s against a team with two traditional bigs. I don't see how the 90s team would keep up. That's all.
We'll talk about that in the final segment of the program. Derek Harper, great 90s point guard with the Knicks and the Mavericks, will disagree, as will Satch Sanders, who won the third most NBA championships with 8 with the Russell teams of the 60s in the Celtics. This is The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord
Welcome
Orthopedics.
Back here on The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. I am Chris Ryan here in the great state of New Hampshire.
Boston Celtics sit at 23-5 to begin this week of play. And coming off a couple of games at home in which the Celtics got a little bit of a scare in the game against the lowly Dallas Mavericks and not so much against the Milwaukee Bucks, paying them back for a win earlier this year where the Bucks beat them in the second game, their home opener. The Celtics, of course, went into Detroit and paid them back for a victory this year where the Pistons knocked off the Celtics a couple of weeks ago. One of the things that stands out most about this Celtics team is they have some commonality with the Patriots, some commonality with the Spurs, and there's a next man up type of attitude. And that really started with the injury to Gordon Hayward, where Jason Tatum, at the age of 19, has found a role for this team, a role in which he is incredibly consistent and a very defined role. He does certain things on the floor, and he does those over and over again. There aren't a lot of plays set for Jason Tatum. There is not a lot of freelancing. You know, he shoots three-point shots. He'll occasionally drive off the dribble and take it to the glass and get a layup or a dunk off of that. I talked with Jason Tatum about the Mavericks' victory because, to me, that was an interesting one. It's a team that championship or really good teams win. They were without Jaylen Brown that night. He had an eye infection. They were without Marcus Morris that night. They're resting his knee. Here is Jason Tatum.
Does a game like tonight showcase this team's, you know, overall depth?
Yeah, especially two of our, you know, one of our starters. I mean, two of our key guys go, you know, not playing. It just shows how, you know, next man mentality. And, you know, every challenge we face, you know, we try our best to overcome it.
What's that like as a group, knowing that you can overcome whatever is thrown at you and you're going to find a way to close at the end?
It's fun. You know, taking on that challenge is fun. You know, we enjoy it, we embrace it, and, you know, try to make it happen.
Coach Stevens talked about before the game about how young players have to kind of simplify things and work off of certain areas. Have you simplified your offensive game just to focus on your three-point shooting and obviously driving the lane you do with the left and the right?
Yeah, I mean, you got Al, Kyrie, you know, those guys on the team. So, you know, you got to, you know, still find a way to be effective and, you know, find your spots. And, you know, shooting threes, attacking the closeouts, you know, cutting, things like that. You just learn as you go.
And this team's depth is really one of its biggest strengths. I mean, in this game, Abdel Nader, Gershon Yabusele stepped up, and Terry Rozier double digits, Shane Larkin double digits. And to me, you know, the Celtics' depth goes beyond even the rotation, which is pretty remarkable for a team with so many young players and so many parts that haven't been, you know, put together in the past. A guy who's really stood out to me, and he's been battling that knee injury, is Marcus Morris. His play has been consistent and good, and he's a much better player than I thought he was. Here's my conversation with Marcus Morris.
Just curious your takeaways as to, you know, how this team prepares and how this team is coached as compared to other teams you've been on the approach.
I think he's like really laid back, really calm, you know. Energy around here is always, you know, really good, and I think our coach did a great job of, you know, keeping everybody involved and, you know, just into it.
How did that meet your expectations for what you thought it was going to be like coming in to this group?
Well, I really didn't know how it was going to be. You know, I've always heard like great things about Brad. So, you know, as we look at the mixture of guys around here, I thought it would be, you know, fun. You know, it's a good group of younger dudes and, you know, veterans around the league. So,
has this gotten better than expected in terms of the continuity with the team and, you know, the role that you found? A lot of people refer to you as kind of the X factor on this team and the guy who has made this team work to a large extent.
I mean, I wouldn't say all that. I think we all do a great job of, you know, feeding off each other, playing off each other, and, you know, just getting wins. I do my job, and, you know, like everybody else who come in, and different days you're gonna have guys that's making, you know what I mean, making a game run or making a, you know, game changing play. So I think it's just always a team, you know, effort, and, you know, I just fall in line and just try to get W's.
Satch Sanders, a guy who played on this team, won 8 championships way back in the day, and he said that this team, in terms of its depth, is similar to the Russell years, and that there's so many interchangeable parts. Is that the kind of one of the things that drives this team? You have, obviously, you go small with you, and you can extend the 3-point line. You can bang with Baines and Tice, and everybody can handle the ball.
We definitely got a lot of versatile guys, a lot of good pieces. Russell, I don't know about all that, but you know, we got a great group of guys. You know, excited to see how far we can take this.
And final thing, when you came in, what did you expect your role was going to be with the?
I wasn't really sure. You know, I mean, I'm still like in a mixture of trying to figure that out. Still, you know what I mean, I'm just trying to, you know, fit in, get in where I fit in, and rather than scoring, defending, or whatever.
Do you feel comfortable though with the way everything's been communicated and how you've been able to, you know, kind of find your niche in minutes?
Yeah, you know, like I'm a veteran. I've been a veteran, so you know, I'm just trying to feed in, you know, just get in where I fit in that, and, you know, just try to stay there for that offensive, you know, versatility, and defensive versatility, because, you know, some nights guys not gonna have it going, and, you know, I step up and, you know, put the load on my back.
Shane Larkin has not played a lot this year, and of course, he was a very highly touted guy coming out of college. He started with the Knicks, and he went over to Europe, and that has really kind of changed who he is as a person and a player. And he had not played in a while. He came off the bench in this game, and he scored 11 points, provided great energy, shot 3 of 5 from 3, and since then, he has found his way back into the rotation again. Now, Shane Larkin has been a really good pickup for the Celtics, and again, a part of that depth outside of just the rotation, that you have injuries and these guys can step up and play. We talked a little with Shane Larkin about that.
What does it say about all you guys that you were ready when the opportunity came? It's obviously the second time for you, the Philly game earlier this year, and now where you've had to rise and you have.
I mean, I've played in this league for a long time, well, feels like a long time, and I've been in every situation. I've started, come off the bench, and not played at all. So I've been in every situation. So mentally, I think I'm prepared for whatever comes to me, and that's what I do every single game. I'm sitting down there talking to those guys, saying ready. And if I get called on, I just go try to do my thing, and hopefully it continues to go well.
How does being able to be engaged? You may play, you may not play.
I think honestly, that's one of the greatest things about me going to Europe was, I think I got drafted at 20 years old, first round pick. I kind of think early in my career, I thought things were just going to be handed to me because of where I got drafted and stuff like that. And I think that wake up call of, yeah, you're a first-round pick, you're going to have opportunities, but if you don't produce, if you don't go out there and give effort and you don't do the right things, then this is not guaranteed. So I think going to Europe really just changed that mindset that when I do step on the court, even if it's not every single game, that I'm going to give 100% effort and try to make it hell for whoever's standing across from me. And that's probably the biggest thing that I gained from going overseas, and that's why I always say it was a great thing for me.
Bro. Just the challenge of doing this as compared to starting and having the role. Like, how do you stay ready when that opportunity presents itself?
I mean, I'm a very confident guy. Mm-hmm. I know I can go play 25 minutes a night and impact the game every single night. But I know now that I've matured and I'm growing and I'm getting older, I understand that we have a very deep team, a very talented team. And some nights it's going to be I play 15 to 20 minutes. Some nights I'm going to play five. Some nights I might not play the whole game, and then in the fourth quarter with 8 minutes left, coach is like, all right, we need some energy. Mm-hmm. Go get in there, Shane, mm-hmm. for 2 minutes and try mm-hmm. to change the pace. So I think just being mentally ready and staying locked in and reading how the game is being played, knowing who's hot, who's not, who's shooting the ball well, what offense we're running, what offense they are running, and just stuff like that. You always got to just stay engaged over there. Of course, I'm going to joke around my teammates some, and whenever Kyrie makes a crazy play, jump up and dance or whatever, but something I'm trying to teach them right now is just always stay locked in, because if you get called in and you don't know a defensive rotation, that looks bad on your part, because it's your job that you're in the NBA to go out there and every single night you're called to go to perform. And I think just staying ready like that and mentally just watching the game, knowing what's coming, and just giving energy is what I do.
Final thing, what's the commonality that you see amongst the guys on this team in regards to being ready? Because everybody has the different thing that they do. They come from different places, but it seems like there's a particular mindset that allows for each person to come in and execute their role, whether it's, you know, in a situation where you don't play very often or consistently. But everyone has a readiness and preparedness when the opportunity presents itself.
A lot of that isn't to any of our individual credit. It goes to Coach Brad. I mean, in practice, he doesn't let the guys that aren't playing that much just sit on the sideline. Mm-hmm. All right, let's just watch the guys that are playing do what they do. He'll randomly call. He called me the other day, all right, get in there with the first unit and run this play. Mm-hmm. Okay, and if I don't know it, then I know that opportunity probably isn't coming in the game. So he mm-hmm. makes sure that everybody's locked in at practice. He's done that several times with Nader, several times with Gershon, several times with Shimmy. He'll put Shimmy at the three, then he'll put him at the four. So he just changes things a lot in practice, and that makes us stay light on our feet. And whatever comes to us in the game, it just helps us react to that then, because we're prepared for it at practice. And he showed us a clip early in the year of the Patriots when Malcolm Butler picked the ball off. Mm-hmm. He showed us a clip of Bill Belichick and them talking about how they practiced that exact same play in practice. Mm-hmm. And they made a mistake on it in practice, and they practiced it again, and he made the right play. And they showed a side-by-side of him picking it off in the game and picking it off in practice, and it was the same exact thing. So just being prepared like that and putting us in situations where we have to react and be ready on an instant is what he's done, and I think that's why whenever anybody's called in here, they're ready to go.
So the Dallas Mavericks come into the TD Garden. That means Dirk Nowitzki, one of the great all-time scorers in NBA history, comes in as well. He, at the age of 39, still somewhat impressive in the NBA. He had a nice game against the Celtics. Didn't shoot it incredibly well. He ended up with 16 points. He's averaging only 11 per game on the season, certainly on the decline. But what's interesting is that, you know, even when he is well defended, when he puts up that fading jump shot, it's either going to fall or it's not. He still is a guy, in my view, who it's very difficult to actually defend. And maybe the legs aren't there the same way they used to be, and maybe he doesn't get the same separation and so forth. But, you know, it feels like his will is still going to be imposed. He's going to get the shot off, and he's going to make the play, and it's not going to be either because you played good defense or not. And the Celtics gave him a number of different looks during the course of the game. I asked Dirk about that, and his answer was very, very honest.
What's your impression of where they stand in terms of the hierarchy of the league? Are they there with all the other, you know, the Warriors, the Cavs?
Well, they showed they've been really, really good, even without Hayward. That they're got a lot of guys who can switch and make plays, and they're very good defensively. I think at some point they were number one in the league. With they got a lot of guys who can move and make it hard on you, and they rebound the ball well, so that usually sets yourself up for to be a good team.
You mentioned you weren't pleased with how you finished the game. So something they did against you matchup-wise, they gave you obviously a number of different looks with Smart and everybody.
I started out of three there, and Harrison posted up, passed it out, and Wolford kind of sunk down really low. Had a great look at it, and it was just a little long, and then shot the one in transition where Dennis kind of flipped it back, ran that play a million times in my 20 years, and just was a little short. And they came down and made us pay for some of our misses. And so, yeah, that was it.
Do you feel as though you're a player that can't be, you know, guarded? Because you kind of talking about that before, with they gave you the looks and so forth, but it was you who missed the shots. Is that your philosophy, that you can't be guarded?
Well, man, maybe 10 years ago, those days are long gone.
And also last week, the Milwaukee Bucks came in, and Giannis Antetokounmpo, who to me is the most exciting player in the NBA right now, when he gets downhill and goes at the rim, he is unbelievable. And the Celtics gave him a number of different looks. They matched up with him with bigs, smalls. He started at center in this game. Giannis is an incredibly fun player to watch.
What do you see as being the difference tonight between you guys and the Celtics? What allowed them to have success?
They just played harder than us, but at the end of the day, I think our effort was good. We were down 20. We came back. We were down 7. We keep fighting. So, just had the extra effort than us.
Is that the number one takeaway to play with them? Is you have to compete harder and on each possession?
Definitely. You got to compete against them because they don't stop playing hard. You know, they're a really good team, and from start to finish, they play hard. They play together. So with a team like that, you gotta keep being disciplined on defense and keep playing hard offensively too.
When you're playing against a number one option like Kyrie, do you go about trying to match them, surpass them? Obviously you're not playing against him during the course of the game, but are you watching what he's doing and trying to, you know, one-up him?
No. I'm just, as a team, just trying to get a win. Come here in Boston and get a win.
Do you prefer playing against bigs or smalls? I mean, Smart was matched up with you a couple of times, at Horford mostly.
Offensively or defensively?
Offensively, when you're on the outside.
Offensively, it doesn't really matter. But defensively, it's harder to play a big man. Because you know they're going to go to the first rebound, gotta box them out. Usually they're stronger than me.
Interesting stuff there from Giannis, who is always very honest about his game and the game itself, and it's been interesting to talk with him over the years. And the Bucks now, you know, progressing upwards. They acquired Eric Bledsoe. They're looking at challenge in the East. Chris Middleton is a great shooter, great scorer. I talked with him about where they stack up, the Bucks, with the Celtics right now.
Do you see there's being a big separation between where you guys are at and where the Celtics are at this point?
I mean, I think 7-8 games ahead of us. I mean, they're on the road, so I mean, we can't worry about them in the number one spot. We have to worry about us.
Do you see, in terms of the basketball court, is there anything that's separating the two teams right now, defensive side or tangibles? What do you see as being kind of the difference?
I honestly can say I don't watch them enough on the court, so I can answer that.
What's the changes that Bledsoe's made to this group? How has he complimented you and Giannis?
He's a point guard. And he's a great scorer too. He knows how to get in the paint and find guys. He knows when to take his shot. He has a great balance and a great feel for the game.
Where do you feel the chemistry is at between the three of you guys at this point?
I don't think it's there yet, honestly. We're still trying to figure each other out. We're just playing off just basketball knowledge. We don't really know how he likes to play and how he doesn't know how we like to play. So, I mean, we're still learning each other, but so far it's been good. Great.
Right here is the somewhat newly acquired Eric Bledsoe.
Just how well has this gone for you in adapting to what the Bucks do, and how much you've enjoyed it?
I mean, it's fun. I'm in a new situation, so anytime you get in a new situation, you just want to play you know, your game and play extremely hard. So, you know, it's been going great.
What are the biggest things you've learned about playing with Giannis as opposed to, you know, watching him on the highlights or competing against him, things that you maybe didn't know about him before and the respect you have for his game?
How hard he plays.
Yeah.
He plays extremely hard. He's a great passer, too. You know, for a big man, he's pretty much a 6'11 point guard. You know, I can play off the ball, on the ball. It doesn't matter. You know, he know how to play the game, man. You know, they call him Greek Freak for a reason.
For you, is it adapting to, you know, to getting the ball from him or getting the ball to him more and trying to work off of him?
I pretty much did it all. I played off the ball, on the ball throughout my career. So I know how to play, with or without it. The biggest thing, you know, for, you know, our team is, you know, getting stops on defense. You know, we've been doing a terrific job of helping each other out on the, you know, defensive end, and it translates into easy baskets for everybody. So, you know, that's the biggest thing for us.
Such a focus on big threes in the game now. Do you feel like now with you here with Middleton and Giannis that now there's the three of this team needs to compete for Eastern Conference title?
I mean, it takes what the whole team. You know, the guys that don't play. You know, the bench that come in. I mean, it takes a, you know, full team effort. And for us, we just, you know, out there trying to, you know, help our team win. And, you know, like I said, we're doing a great job of that, playing off each other. The bench coming in doing a hell of a job. And, you know, the guys that don't play doing a hell of a job of, you know, cheering us on. So, you know, this is a team full team effort.
This is The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. That segment of the show brought to you by the Prescription Center, where the health of you and your family comes first.
Welcome back. This is The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. In this final segment of the program, Al Horford said that today's game was the best it has ever been. In his view. And, you know, he's been around the game since the 2008, his rookie year. Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett, Ray Allen won the championship that year. And he thinks the game now is the best it's ever been. He's a student of the game, grew up watching the game. And you tend to feel, Matt, I think the same way, that the game is now as good as it's ever been. Satch Sanders played with Russell and Cousy. And I agree with him in that I think that the players of that time period, or the 80s or the 90s, 70s, whenever, I think that the top players may not have the same numbers, but their skill, intellect, and competitiveness would allow for them to adapt to the game. Now, some of the other players, the bench guys, the role players, you know, maybe they wouldn't find a role in the game today, but maybe some of the guys today wouldn't find a role in the game back then as it evolves. Derek Harper thinks he's straight ahead. He thinks the game was the best in the 90s with Jordan and Patrick and all them. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, like the way back guys, I was saying what you said. Like, I think they're competitive, great players. They could figure it out given their competitiveness and, you know, whatever skill set they had back then. And I agree with you. I don't think their numbers would quite be the same. As far as the 90s go, it's a clash, like I said, it's a clash of style.
Right.
I don't think you physically look at players in the 90s and players today and think, well, players today have a huge advantage. I think you can say that a little bit about, you know, players from the 50s and 60s compared to players now.
Even the 80s, given, I think you could say there's a difference. In,
Just given the advancement of nutrition and strengthening, you know, the popularity of the sport, for whatever reason, it just seems like the game's gotten more athletic. The 90s, I don't know if you could say that as much. There were some really athletic, strong guys back then. It's just a clash of styles, an evolution of the game, style of play. It would be interesting, you know, If only there was a way to, you know, put the Warriors or the Cavs or our championship team against the Bulls or the Celtics or the Lakers in the late 80s and see what would have happened. It would be interesting for sure. But, you know, we talked a couple of weeks ago about, you know, especially in the mid to late 80s, these teams that would score 120 points a game, and hit like two threes in the whole game.
Right.
Like how is that possible? Like is the defense that poor? You know, to me it's more like the defensive side. Like how bad is your defense if you're giving up 130 points and yet only giving up two or three threes in the whole game?
Yeah, I agree. I think that the defensive competitiveness was not nearly as high as it was now. And if you watch those games, the classic Celtics games from the 80s, I think that's a pretty fair statement. I think the defense was tougher in the playoffs than it was in the regular season, but I think that there wasn't as much team defense.
Yeah, and that's another interesting thing is the refereeing has evolved too. Like, how does that come into play?
They call a lot more fouls.
Guys in the 90s said, used to be able to beat the crap out of each other.
Yep.
Used to be able to make statement fouls, just go up and deck someone.
Yep.
And it would just be a common foul. But maybe if you really drilled someone, you'd get a technical, but you wouldn't get ejected, Or a fight would break out. Only the instigator would get ejected. Everybody else would get to stay in the game.
Right.
So there's that kind of that whole toughness side of things as far as, evolution of the game. I think that's a huge part of it, too. How would that come into play? There's so many factors that it's really hard to say.
Let's start with a little bit of my conversation with Satch Sanders.
Check, check. There's been a lot of discussion about today's game and how it compares to years past in the NBA, and if players from your era, the Bob Cousys, the Bill Russells, the Wilt Chamberlains, how they would adapt to today's game. And I'm curious your perspective on if you feel they would have the same impact today as they did back then, or similar, more, less.
I don't think there's any question that the players you've mentioned, okay, could play. Russell, Chamberlain, guys like that could not only play, but star mm-hmm. in the league as it is now. Interestingly enough, Wilt Chamberlain, of course, was a weightlifter.
Mm-hmm.
So he would certainly fit right mm-hmm. in with this genre. Russell was not, but Russell, of course, had the ability to rebound extraordinarily well, and possession is what the game is really all about. Mm-hmm. As many possessions as you can get and take shots, etc. More shots. Key fast breaks. Not many guys focus on the boards the way Russell and Chamberlain did. Okay? Or Moses Malone, for that matter. Mm-hmm. So those people would still have tremendous impact, not just play. Impact.
Do you think that Bill Russell would shoot threes in today's game? Do you think that he would be drawn out similar to Horford or any big in the game now? It seems they shoot three-pointers. Even Pau Gasol is shooting three-pointers now. Do you think that Russell would operate in the offense up top and be similar to an Al Horford? He is similar in size. Do you think he would operate up there?
Well, he certainly wouldn't have a problem trying to come out and guard him mm-hmm. because his footwork was that good. But, most of your three-point shooters, on the average, are shooting about 30-35%.
Mm-hmm.
You're not worried, percentage-wise, if you're running a team, a coach, you're not worried about the big man on the other team shooting four three-point shots. Taking four or five three-point shots during the game, that's not going to frighten you. You're going to worry about him getting in the hole, top of the circle, in. It's not enough to worry about.
Do you think their stats would adapt more to the current environment? Or obviously, Will Chamberlain scored 100 points in a game. Bill Russell averaged 30 rebounds per contest. Cousy had obviously an incredible amount of assists. Do you think that there would be an alteration of their numbers from when they played to now, and they'd still star? Or do you think their numbers would be similar?
Well, I think it would be similar simply because the guys you're talking about, the outstanding players at that particular time, had a value. Cousy's 12, whatever the assists happened to be, mm-hmm. would still be of serious value for anyone playing today. The Russell's 20-something rebounds a game certainly may not be 20-something rebounds, but it wouldn't be far. It would be 18 to 20 instead. Wilt, I don't know. Wilt could almost go to
go to the top of the backboard. Remember, he was a superior athlete. Mm-hmm. So these guys would still be extremely effective. You know, what people tend to forget is how important the middle court shooters mm-hmm. and scorers are. Okay? Most of your points are still scored mm-hmm. in that area of the court. So it's nice to glorify the three-point shot, but the thing that's going to win the games are the shots in the paint and the shots from the foul line on in.
What if you took some of today's players, the Kyrie Irvings, the handle that he has, and you brought him back to the 50s and 60s, Shaq, brought him back to the 50s and 60s. What do you think their impact would be? Because we make the argument about how the game has changed, and there's all the focus and emphasis on nutrition and well-being and so forth that may not have existed in the 50s and 60s to the extent it does now, the preparation and so forth. But also you had to play under much more difficult conditions where everything, it seems, is set up perfectly for players of today to have success, where in regards to travel, equipment, shoes, courts, lighting, all of it, it was much more of a challenge in your environment. So do you think the stars of today, the Kevin Durants, the LeBron Jameses, and Kyrie Irvings, how would they react to playing in your era?
Well, they're superior players. And when you talk about players of that skill level, they'd make the adjustment mm-hmm. because of a lack of choice. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's no place else to play. If this is the way they're playing now, guess what? They'd be playing that way. If you're talking about Durant, the difference would be the physicality of the game. At that particular time, we were allowed to keep more hands, be more physical with players. And in the 50s and 60s, there were a heck of a lot more fights.
Yeah.
So if you're going to change all the rules back to that particular time, then some of the guys will have to be more adept at dealing with the physicality of the game, because that was very different.
So basically, it's your belief that players are players, and the superior players from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, regardless of what the era or their time period may be, the stats may change, but the player will find a way to have success in the environment. So if you're a superior player, no matter what era, whether it's early in the game of basketball or late in the game of basketball, they will. The great players are the great players.
Mm-hmm. I definitely believe that. The fact that sometimes I hear people compare Magic, Oscar mm-hmm. Robertson, and let's say Michael Jordan. Mm-hmm. Now, when you look at the point totals, 2 points, 2 points. Mm-hmm. The difference is that Michael was more stylistic mm-hmm. and had tremendous leaping power, etc. Still 2 points. Mm-hmm. See, and that's what people sort of forget. This is they get excited about the style of play. That doesn't stop. That doesn't deal with the effectiveness of these players. You may have to go behind your back and through your legs 300 times, mm-hmm. but recognize one thing. They're not moving when they're doing all this dribbling. So defensively, if you are able to keep your hands on them and keep your eyes on them, that part, you don't have to worry about the handle because you're concerned where the player is going. But I will admit, watching some of these guys handle, I look at the Kyrie, it's a pleasure to watch him from an entertainment perspective.
Yeah.
But you say to yourself, I wish that the defensive guys, sometimes when they play against the really talented players, if they stuck to the basics, they'd be able to stay with them much easier.
Fouling, the three-point shot in basketball, obviously it came in the early 80s after your time period playing, but it's funny, in retrospect, you think about Larry Bird as being, a legendary three-point shooter coming in and, going to three-point shooting contests and saying who's finishing second and all that. He shot, on average, just a little over 100 three-pointers per year, and Marcus Smart, through 24 games, has over 100 three-pointers in this season. So it's been amazing to see the adaptation of how predominant the three-pointer has become. Do you think that has hurt or hindered the game, or has allowed for the court to be spread and the opportunity to exist for a driving game?
Well, the important thing about spreading, as far as I'm concerned, if you've got a really good inside guy, if Shaq is your target mm-hmm. inside, then he has some advantages if you can spread the court. Mm-hmm. Okay? But what happens many times is people will stay a little closer to the really good three-point shooter and let the adequate three-point shooter take the shots, because percentage-wise, that's what you want to happen out there, okay? So he's shooting 30% or less. The adequate ones are shooting just 25, 30% three-pointers. You're not worrying about three-point shots. You're worrying about outside shots, okay? Spreading the courts on was nice. The biggest thing that works nowadays, the biggest factor, and I don't hear too many people talking about them, is that the picks move. Mm-hmm. You have moving picks now. Mm-hmm. In our day, you had to stand still. Mm-hmm. And that's a factor that's missed totally. Make all the difference in the world. You couldn't set the moving picks in when we played, simply speaking, because you'd have to fight. The guy who runs into a moving pick and the moving pick gets away with it, get ready to throw some hands, because you're getting an advantage.
Right.
So the pick stood still.
Yeah.
Now I see picks guys just folding themselves, they're sticking, they're pushing. It's, if you're going to allow that, hey, anybody could play. Anybody who makes the pros could play now.
The most frequent one is the pick up top, where the big rolls into the small, and the point guard comes around, and then he rolls out for the three-point shot, and where he's kind of moving in and then off to the side.
Hey, even in college ball, rules were set up so that the guy had to have at least one step. The defender had to at least have one step. Now the guys walk right up on the defensive guy and stops. And that's a pick, and it's allowed. Something's wrong with that picture, okay? If I were playing, I wouldn't put up with it maybe once before I try and hurt somebody. If the referees were allowing him to get away with it, then he might as well get ready to allow me to get away with what I'm going to want to get away with, okay? To even the game out. So, but things change, attitudes change. The style is to open it up and flow, and they really think that this is working. I think the teams that win championships, et cetera, score from top of circle in.
Yeah.
There's always room for the three-point shooter. Yeah, the guy makes it, good. If he doesn't, you know, it's another shot. But the game is won from the top of circle in, the percentage shots.
Sweet. Good to see you. Everything good?
All right, the Celtics' great number 16, Satch Sanders right there. Here's Derek Harper, a great point guard in the 90s for the Knicks and Mavericks.
So we've been having a debate about, you know, which era of the game was the best. And talk
my
to
era.
I figure that's where you're going to head. And that's the era that I grew up in. That's the era I grew up in the 90s. Why do you say the 90s basketball and your point guard for the Knicks was the best?
Well, I think that then players were a lot more fundamentally sound. You couldn't give guys open shots. And all due respect to the new school, they're a lot more athletic. You see some freakish plays in the open court nowadays, so I'll give them that. But I just think the overall game was, the league was better as well. But overall, just players were more, just had more savvy as basketball players in general. You know, you couldn't give guys open shots back then. You know, Reggie Miller, Larry Bird, you know, the list is long, of course, but I don't think guys really pay attention to the fundamentals anymore. I think people just play now, which is good because the game has gone to a more open game, kind of pace and space, they call it. And, you know, you have to go with the flow, more or less, of what's going on in the league, and that's what's happening now. But, I mean, I'm an old school guy, and I'm going to support the old school every single time this question comes up. So, and it's not biased. I just think if you go up and down the list, people would agree,
if they're
honest.
I remember Sam Cassell, when he was with the Celtics here in 08, was talking to KG and Pierce, those guys, about, you know, the finals in 94, and he would talk about the hand check and how you would, and him would hand check each other so hard that you'd have basically like bruises in each other's backs at the end of things.
That's a little bit of an exaggeration. However, you play to what you can get away with, especially on the defensive end of the floor. And back then, you were allowed to touch guys. You could ride guys up and down the court, so you use it as an advantage. And it wasn't like I was the only one doing it. Everybody was doing it. Sam, to Sam's point, you got away with that, and that's what the game was about, man. It was a more physical game back then. I think the league, David Stern wanted more scoring and more of an entertaining league, so that rule was changed. But you know, it was a lot more physical, more fights, more. Not that that's good for the game, but because of the physicality of it back then, there were more breakout fights and things of that nature. But overall, and from a defensive standpoint, that helps you, because if you can hit a guy before he's crossing the lane to get post position, you could get away with something and do your work early, more or less, is what they call it. You know, you bump a guy, check a guy is what the bigs used to call it. You know, little guys now would have gotten hurt, because if you came down in the lane back then trying to dunk on a big guy, you would get knocked out. I mean, Rick Mahorn, Lonnie Shelton, I mean, those guys caught me in the back, and, you know, I got a knot on my eye or something, you know? So from that standpoint, it's just completely different. It probably won't ever be the same, to be quite frank with you.
It feels like there's a change, too, between the 80s and the 90s in regards to how the physicality was policed by the league. I remember back here with the Pistons and the Celtics, and, you know, Robert Parrish was throwing hands at Billy Laimbeer. He didn't even get a foul. I think he got a regular foul for it. And the flagrant foul really became prolific, you know, around your time with the Knicks in the 90s. But it feels like, you know, the lack there's still a lot of physicality, and you still see that, particularly when you're close to the game. Yeah. But it feels like the physicality has been over-policed, perhaps, with the flagrant fouls.
I would completely concur with you, 100%. You know, I see flagrant fouls some nights, and I think back to what you're talking about in the past players in the league, and it's literally somewhat of a joke, to be honest with you, when you see some of the calls. I don't want to bash the NBA. I don't want to bash officials and all of that. They're doing what they have to do to keep things under control, and I don't think people come to a game expecting a boxing match or fights and all of that kind of stuff to break out. But if you ask bigs back then, Charles Oakley would laugh. You know, Bill Laimbeer, Robert Parrish, Kevin McHale, those guys would laugh at flagrant fouls right now, because you can't touch guys, you know. And in a lot of ways, it's unfortunate, but in a lot of ways, it's good for the game, because the flow of the game is a lot better and more entertaining.
Final thing, I was talking with Satch Sanders, the Celtics legend, about this, who's on the Russell teams in the 60s. And, you know, I've been debating with a lot of the modern players. Al Horford will say that this is the best the league has ever been, and so forth. And, you know, and guys today will say that, you know, Bob Cousy or Bill Russell, those guys would have trouble playing in the game today and putting the numbers up that they had.
It's a blatant lie is what that is. You're talking Satch Sanders and who did you say? Bill Russell?
Bill Russell, Bob Cousy.
I mean, you guys have more banners than anybody in the history of basketball, professional basketball. So I don't think that's the case. And, of course, you're going to adjust to how the game is being officiated. But you tell me how a guy that makes other people better with the sense of simply being a facilitator won't be able to play now. Bob Cousy could play then. He could play in the 80s, the 90s, and I promise you he could play right now, because he's astute enough to adjust to whatever the game forces you to do. And, you know, I don't like that's one of the reasons why, I mean, I love where you're coming from, but I don't like to discuss it because it's completely different because of the rule changes and all of those different things. But don't start telling me that I couldn't play in the NBA now. And there are nights where I sit as a color analyst and say that this league, and again, I don't want to come across as bashing, make sure you put this part in, as bashing the NBA, but I mean, there are nights where I think it would be lunch meat out here for me. I feel like I'd be taking candy from a baby playing against some of the guys that I see play at the point guard position right now. I mean, just physicality alone, I would be able to play in this league. I mean, I love this league. I mean, I'm working in this league right now, and I appreciate what these guys are and what they bring to the table night in and night out. However, you got to be kidding me. Bill Russell couldn't have dominated this league. I mean, Bill Russell could pass the basketball. He did whatever it took to be successful. And when you do whatever it takes as a player to make things happen, I mean, I don't know who told you that. I don't know if Al Horford really knows.
Al Horford didn't say that. He said the game was better today than it's ever been before. He didn't say anything about Cousy or Russell.
I'd like to see if Al Horford could survive back then, playing in that era. And I love his game and love what he does as a player, but, you know, come on, man. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. You've been listening to The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. Great discussion there about the great game of basketball. It's evolved, obviously, over the years. Matt, as always, appreciate you joining us for the show.
All right, thanks for having me.
This is The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. That segment of the show brought to you by Douglas, Leonard, and Garvey in NHLawOffice.com.
Play.